This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the ramifications of the dismissal of the New Jersey federal court case challenging the New York City Police Department's spying on Muslims in New Jersey. This is obviously a case of religious profiling. There's a similar case being litigated here in New York City. Will a precedent be set? We look into the merger of mega corporations Time Warner and Comcast. Free Press Policy Director, Attorney Matt Wood, tells us why we should be very worried about this.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm going to read you a letter we got from a listener. The letter was prompted by the remark I made at the book launch party for our new book, which I co-edited, called Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. And at the book launch party last month, I made the observation that democracy in this country is extremely stilted, in as much as the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court allows corporations to donate as much money as they want to both capitalist parties. Their reasoning was a corporation is a person. Thus, the Supreme Court bestowed corporate personhood on a legal fiction. And I observed that I'll believe a corporation is a person the day it gets a colonoscopy. To this observation, a listener wrote me the following. He said, "Amen, and apropos, here's my rewrite of that famous soliloquy in The Merchant of Venice as spoken by the now corporate Shylock. I am a corporation. Hath not a corporation eyes? Hath not a corporation tentacles, jaws, fangs, bloated belly, insatiable appetites? Is a corporation not fed with the same paperwork, hurt with the same indictments, subject to the same subpoenas, healed by the same profits, warmed and cooled by the same nuclear winter and global warming, as a person of flesh and blood is? If you prick us, do we not leak oil? If you tickle us, do we not laugh all the way to the bank? If you poison us, do we not pass the poison along to our shareholders? And if you wrong us, do we not see you in court, which, by the way, we own?" A tip of the hat to Mikhail Horowitz for that observation on corporations. The 6th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up April 18th through 20th at the Bell House, 7th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue in Brooklyn. You can get information on it from brooklynfolkfestival.com. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is presented by Down Home Radio and the Jalopy Theater. It'll feature a Pete Seeger tribute and a sing-along, plus the Downhill Strugglers with John Cohn and the East River String Band with R. Crumb. There'll be a square dance, films, workshops, and the infamous banjo toss, where they throw a banjo into the Gowanus Canal. The person throwing it the furthest wins a banjo. Not the sacrificial one, but a new one. So check out the Brooklyn Festival at brooklynfolkfest.com, April 18th through 20th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Take a look into the failed lawsuit challenging the New York City Police Department's broad surveillance of Muslims in New Jersey. The case Hassan versus the City of New York, brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Muslim Advocates was dismissed last month. Since 2002, the New York City Police Department spied outside its jurisdiction on at least 20 mosques, 14 restaurants, 11 retail stores, 2 grade schools, and 2 Muslim student associations in New Jersey. The monitoring included using racial and ethnic profiling systems, video surveillance, photographing, community mapping, and infiltration. We talk with returning guest Professor Deepa Kumar, an associate professor of Media Studies and Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. She is the author of the book Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Professor Deepa Kumar, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, it's nice to have you back. You know, this decision out in federal court over what the New York Police Department was doing in New Jersey in spying on Muslims was really shook me up. And I wanted to start off by asking you about the decision. Who were the plaintiffs? Who were the defendants? What was the judge's reasoning? Why did he throw it out? And then we can get into the details of the illogic and racism behind it.
Absolutely. Well, it was very troubling for me too, Michael, because Rutgers, where I teach, we found out that the NYPD had a so-called safe house just off of our New Brunswick campus when the landlord actually called the local police saying that there was some suspicious activity, and then the NYPD was sort of busted. But it's really troubling that student groups on my campus and elsewhere, not to mention, you know, grade schools and Muslim, you know, bookstores and community centers have been invaded in this kind of fashion. And, of course, it's created, you know, a chilling sentiment among the Muslim American community. People self-censor. They're afraid of, you know, what they say will be used against them in entrapment cases and so on. And this decision by this judge is just completely stunning. The logic that he puts forward, and I'm reading from his 10-page report, he says, quote, "The police could not have monitored New Jersey for Muslim terrorist activities without monitoring the Muslim community itself. The motive for the program was not solely apparently to discriminate against Muslims, but rather to find Muslim terrorists hiding among ordinary law-abiding Muslims," end quote.
What's this judge's name?
Martini. His name is Judge Martini.
Judge Martini. He sits in the Federal District Court in New Jersey.
Yes. A somewhat controversial judge. People have complained about him, and he was a Bush appointee. He has some pretty conservative and downright reactionary ideas.
Yeah, well, I'll say, what do you think the logic of this decision is?
Well, if you examine what he says, essentially it's the notion that there are terrorists in the Muslim American community, and therefore, you know, it's all right to go out and spy on them and invade their privacy and deny them the right to religion and so forth. And that's just, you know, stunning in terms of the logic of it. It's based on this notion that somehow Islam serves to radicalize Muslim Americans into performing political violence. And of course, you know, this program, as you mentioned earlier, has been active since 2002, but there has not been one terrorism-related lead, let alone any kind of conviction. So, you know, nothing of the sort has been found. But let's look at this logic, since that's the question that you asked me. Since the events of 9/11, there have been all sorts of pseudoscientific attempts to show that somehow the religion Islam creates political violence, right? And there's a great new book that has come out by Arun Kundanani called The Muslims Are Coming, where he looks at these theories of radicalization from the FBI, from the NYPD, and so forth, and he shows through his rigorous research that, in fact, religion really has nothing to do with why people turn to political violence. So, for instance, you know, if you look at Hamas, the group in Palestine, they turn to the Quran to justify both violence as well as to justify ceasefires, right? And so it's politics, really, that is the key reason why people turn to violence. And so to somehow blame Islam, this is a form of cultural racism.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the ramifications of this judge's decision? Because there's a similar suit pending here in New York City against the New York City Police Department for its surveillance of Muslims here. Do you think that this may set a precedent?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the NYPD is going beyond its jurisdiction in spying on Muslims in New Jersey. But of course, we know from the Associated Story investigative journalistic report. And by the way, I just want to say this also about the judge's ruling. In his 10-page report, he says the harm, such as it was, that was done to the Muslim American community in New Jersey was apparently not by this program of surveillance, but because the Associated Press actually carried a report and exposed what the NYPD was doing. So, you know, there you have it in one fell swoop, not only a justification for religious and racial profiling, but also, you know, an attack on the freedom of press, the idea that the press should actually act as guarantors of democracy, as the watchdog of the government. But to come back to the other case that you were talking about in Brooklyn and the precedent that this sets, I mean, what this says is that the NYPD can, with impunity, go around spying on religious minorities, not just in New York City, but in New Jersey, in Connecticut, and what have you. And frankly, it goes beyond that, isn't it? Because it sends a green light to other police departments across the country, as well as the FBI, which has similar programs, to continue, because, you know, a precedent has been set by this New Jersey judge. And actually, he justified his ruling by referring to a case in the Supreme Court, Ashcroft versus Iqbal, where a similar kind of, precedent was actually set. So I think we have a lot of work to do ahead of us in pushing back against this racist logic.
Is this decision by Judge Martini going to be appealed by the Center for Constitutional Rights or Muslim advocates?
Absolutely. In the reports that I've seen and the press releases that I've seen from both groups, they believe that this is a completely wrong decision. And they are actually quite confident that if they appeal, this will get overturned. Again, because people have a lot of questions about this particular Judge Martini, the kind of rulings that he has, you know, issued over the last few years, and how he's sort of out of sync with the rest of the judicial community. So that's the hope, is to appeal, and we'll see what happens.
We're speaking with Professor Deepa Kumar, who has written the book Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, and we're speaking about the very dismaying decision by Federal Judge Martini in New Jersey, throwing out a lawsuit that challenged the New York City Police Department's going over to New Jersey and spying on the Muslim community. And the racism behind this lawsuit was reminiscent for me, Deepa, of the racism behind the putting in concentration camps 110,000 Japanese during World War II on the basis that they were Japanese. And I wanted your reaction to that observation.
No, that's absolutely right, Michael. You have found the exact perfect example to actually make a comparison, because if you look again at the Supreme Court decision in relation to the incarceration of 110,000 Japanese Americans, by the way, the vast majority of them were American citizens, the logic there was that this was justified because the United States was at war with Japan, and therefore an entire group of people becomes a suspicious people who should be thrown behind jail, never mind that, you know, none of them had actually done anything. And the same kind of logic is being applied here in the case of Muslim Americans. I mean, I think it's worth looking, for instance, at, the idea that, you know, some people claim that there is no such thing as racism against Muslims because Muslims aren't a race. And that is true, and I would respond to that claim in two ways. First of all, the idea that there are biological races has been, you know, quite effectively debunked over the last 3 to 4 decades in work that has been done in genetics. In fact, there is, you know, tremendous variation among, you know, human to human in terms of our genetic makeup. And 85% of this variation occurs within a so-called race. So the idea that there are these biological races is, of course, a myth. But the question is, why are we calling this racism against Muslims? Because it's a form of cultural racism, because it's premised on the notion that Islam somehow creates an ideology, it creates a culture that programs people to act in violent ways. And there are two versions of this theory of Islamic radicalization. One of them is the more conservative, reactionary kind of the kind that I'm sure Martini subscribes to, which is that all Muslims are sort of, you know, terrorists in waiting. They are like ticking time bombs who will someday explode, and that's why the NYPD should have a program that spies on all of them, because you never know when they're going to become terrorists, right? This is like the film, the Steven Spielberg film Minority Report, where there is this so-called precog unit that can tell, that can identify today people who might be criminals tomorrow, right? And
that's real ridiculous. Science fiction.
So that's one view. The other view is the more liberal view, and here people say that there are moderate Muslims and then there are extremist Muslims, and we should use the moderates to ferret out the extremists. And again, you know, I refer people to Arun Kundanani's book, where he shows that this is also an extremely flawed understanding, because in fact, the reason why people turn to violence very often is because peaceful movements have failed, right? So you take some examples. You look at the Provisional Irish Republican Army in the 1970s. Its turn to violence comes because of the failure of a peaceful civil rights movement in Northern Ireland to actually win justice for the national community. You look at the Weather Underground in the United States coming out of the anti-war movement. They turn to violence only after, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who come out against the Vietnam War fail to actually stop the Vietnam War. Similarly, the African National Congress turns to violence when the nonviolent actions have failed. And so religion, really, no matter what religion it is, Islam, Christianity, Catholicism, what have you, has very little to do with it. And the problem is that this idea has now become dominant, the idea that somehow Muslims are more prone to violence, and that's why that's racist.
I think that violence is not a good idea. For one thing, it puts the onus of violence on us rather than on the U.S. government, where it rightfully belongs. And also, it doesn't work. And the example of the Vietnam anti-war movement is a good one, because eventually those huge demonstrations that we organized did work.
Yeah.
And the United States had to get out of there because the anti-war sentiment spread throughout the country, and it spread to the U.S. military.
That's
and at
right.
one point, the U.S. military refused to fight. And at that point, the United States packed it up and left Vietnam. But I wanted to go back to, a very good point you made on cultural racism. And George Bush, 43, the junior, after 9/11, his explanation, which was a classic cultural racism explanation for why those criminals bombed the World Trade Center with their planes, Bush's explanation was that they hate us because of our freedom. And there was no discussion of the underlying politics. I mean, I think those people were mass murderers, and anybody involved in that should have been found, arrested, convicted, and imprisoned. But there was never a discussion about what motivated them, except for that stupid remark of Bush saying they hate us because of our freedom. And there was actually, it was a political act. The people that supported that act gave reasons for it. But we never had that discussion. They gave three reasons. They said that the United States supported Israel against the Palestinians, that the United States starved 600,000 children who died in Iraq with sanctions, and that the United States had military bases in Saudi Arabia next to two holy cities, Mecca and Medina. And for those three reasons, they picked the World Trade Center as their target and hit it. But we never had that discussion about what their politics were and why their tactics were wrong and why these people were criminals. Instead, it was declared a military act, and the United States responded by first bombing Afghanistan and then falsely blaming Iraq for having connections with al-Qaeda, and then launching an aggressive war against Iraq. So the whole discussion never took place. And it seems to me that we're living in that same kind of world where Muslims are the enemy, and there's no intelligent discussion about Muslims and what motivates people to act.
I think that's absolutely right. Of course, this, you know, Bush did not speak out of his own wisdom or lack thereof. He was schooled by a group of people that were brought together immediately after the events of 9/11, who were tasked with how the U.S. government should respond to the events of 9/11. because, you know, they simply didn't have the language. And one of the people who was invited to the White House is a man by the name of Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis, an Orientalist scholar at Princeton University, he's the person who coined the term clash of civilizations,
yes,
which Samuel Huntington then popularizes, which is based on the notion that conflict, such as it exists between people in Muslim-majority countries and the so-called West, neither of, you know, these are monoliths of these sorts don't make any sense, is not because of political differences, it's not because of political grievances. You know, in addition to the ones you mentioned, let's look at the U.S.'s role in the Middle East in terms of squashing democratic movements, whether it's the overthrow of the democratically elected Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 because he dared to nationalize the oil of Iran, or, you know, what have you. There are any number of incidents where the U.S. thwarts the aspirations of ordinary people and props up dictators and so on. The argument for the clash of civilizations, people, is let's put that all aside and make this a clash about culture, because there are deep cultural differences, apparently, that force people to fight with one another. And I think we have to seriously, you know, debunk this theory, and we have to expose the real reasons why people get upset with the United States. I mean, Seymour Hersh, the journalist who broke My Lai, came to my school and gave a lecture a long time ago, I want to say almost in 2005, 2006, where he was talking about covering Afghanistan, and he said that he was speaking to this young person who joined the Taliban, and he asked him, why did you join the Taliban? And I think he talked about this young man as being like 14 or 15 years old, so actually a boy. He says, well, I was at a wedding with my family, and a U.S. bomb came, and it destroyed everything and everybody I know. And this was the only thing left for me to do, is to fight against the people who are destroying my country. So rather than focus on, you know, the concept of blowback, and by the way, this is a concept that the CIA developed, which is about the unintended consequences of U.S. actions around the world, rather than put the spotlight there and actually, you know, stop the U.S. from doing things that make a tiny minority of people around the world angry enough to carry out violence against, you know, innocent people in the U.S. Frankly, 9/11 was, you know, didn't kill anybody who was actually responsible for these atrocities. The way to stop that kind of violence is to, you know, basically put empire in check, to hold empire in check. And that's what, as you said, the student movement of the 1960s actually did quite successfully.
We're speaking with Deepa Kumar, who's a professor at Rutgers, and she wrote the important book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Deepa, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now.
I'm glad you asked, Michael. I'm actually working on a book on the cultural logic of the national security state. One of the things that Edward Snowden's leaks have shown is just how huge and massive the surveillance state has actually become in the United States and around the world, frankly, so much so that those of us who grew up reading George Orwell's 1984, right, we're kind of stunned to see how George Orwell could not have imagined the extent to which people are actually surveilled today. It's not just, you know, televisions and cameras, but it is our cell phones, who we call, where we are, because our cell phones have GPS tracking, our health conditions, even our dreams, hopes, and fears, which are recorded on social media. So every aspect of our life is being recorded in this kind of way. And the truth of the matter is that we need to figure out how it is that we have been somehow convinced that this is okay. And I'm looking at, you know, campaigns like If You See Something, Say Something, which if you, you know, you look at it for a second, what's being asked of you is to become an agent of state surveillance, right? And a whole bunch of television shows and so forth have actually played this role, like 24, like Homeland and so forth, in lulling us into believing that somehow we have an interest in this national security state, which, you know, a national security state, in case your listeners don't know what it is a society in which every aspect of life, intellectual, political, social, economic, is diverted towards supposed national security, and you see the proliferation of a whole bunch of institutions supposedly there to keep us safe. But, you know, let's make no mistake about it. Other commentators have made this point, but I do as well in this book that I'm writing, is that this national security state is not about keeping us safe. It is about advancing and securing the interests of the 1%. Why? Because it's not just Muslim Americans who are being spied upon. And by the way, here's a statistic that's kind of mind-boggling. If you calculate the number of spies, for instance, in East Germany, the Stasi to East German citizens, there was one spy for every 66 people. And people who have done the calculation in the U.S., now find that that number is actually quite similar if you look at all the national security agencies of the agents spying on Muslims. So that's where we are, you know, today. And so we've got to think about these issues critically, and we've got to look at the fact that they are spying also on dissidents, right? You look at some of the national security documents, particularly since 2008, what they're concerned about are people who they think will cause, quote-unquote, civil unrest, because of, you know, the economic crisis, because of the environmental crisis, and so on. So they're going after people in the Occupy Wall Street movement, in environmental activists, and so on. So in many ways, the world that George Orwell, you know, imagined in 1984, which was, by the way, a society that was at perpetual war, in which independent thinking was punished and policed, we're not yet there, but we are starting to get to that point, and we are being convinced to give up information about ourselves with the, you know, mythology that we have, if we have nothing to hide, then we should be able to share all this information, and people don't seem to recognize that, you know, anything you say can and will be used against you, as it was in the case of activists in the 1960s, from Martin Luther King to, you know, a whole bunch of other activists.
What's the book going to be called?
See Something, Say Something, The Cultural Logic of the National Security State.
And when can we anticipate being able to read it?
Oh, my gosh. If I could tell you that, Michael, I would be rich.
Well, Deepa Kumar, it's been a real pleasure having you on Law and Disorder. And when the book comes out, we want you to come back. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. With the proposed $45 billion Comcast-Time Warner cable merger, many are worried that net neutrality may be compromised. The proposed merger would unite our nation's largest cable TV and internet service provider with the second largest cable company. And if combined, the companies would provide service to two-thirds of U.S. households. While the deal must be approved by the U.S. Justice Department and the FCC, many are wondering what it might mean for antitrust laws and net neutrality. We're joined today by Free Press Policy Director Matt Wood to talk about the wider implications.
Attorney Matt Wood, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Matt, I wanted to ask you about the proposed merger between the cable giants Comcast and Time Warner Cable. What should we be worried about here?
Well, the cable company is really nobody's favorite, usually, for customer service or low prices or anything else that we need from our communications tools that cable provides us with. And what we would have here is a $45 billion deal combining the nation's largest and second largest cable companies. And they face some competition, especially for video, from satellite providers if people actually live in a place where they can use a satellite. Not everybody does. But the place where they really don't face any effective competition at all is on the broadband platform. And this deal would strengthen them both in their traditional cable TV programming dominance and on the broadband side, too. So you'd have one company that reaches about two-thirds of the country, and that is really the only option most people have for advanced communication services, putting video and broadband together. They'd be basically the only provider to about 40% of the country for those kinds of true high-speed internet services. So that will just give them tremendous power over everything we see, both on TV and online. Comcast is already sort of a must-have for any independent programmer, for even web providers like Netflix, as we saw from a deal announced between Comcast and Netflix a few days ago now. This would just strengthen their control and really their stranglehold and their gatekeeper power on free expression and free commerce that flows over the internet today.
So we should be very worried.
Yeah, we think so. I mean, what they will say is that they don't compete today in any markets. You know, you don't have Comcast and Time Warner Cable both available in the same geographic location. And I always like to pause for a second there and think about the antitrust implications of that. And the some might call it discipline, others might call it collusion that led us to that place. But, you know, that's not the world we want to have going forward. There is the potential for them to compete in the future, because now you can actually get your video over broadband, as a lot of people do, and as a lot of people do more and more. So it's not like that's written in stone, that they should never compete. But even without that direct horizontal competition today between Comcast Cable and Time Warner Cable, this is not good news for the American people, for free expression, for lower prices, for really anything we care about, as so much of our lives now runs through those internet connections that Comcast and Time Warner Cable provide.
Let me make this personal. Law and Disorder is broadcast on stations around the country, but we also have an internet site. And should we be worried people's access to our internet site might be blocked, or they could just pull the switch on us, that we won't be able to reach out the way we've been doing for the last 9 years? Should this concern people like myself on Law and Disorder getting our ideas out via the internet?
Yeah, it definitely should. And this is a topic that is oftentimes referred to as net neutrality, and something else that we work on a lot here at my organization.
Well, educate me about that, because I know the term,
sure,
but I'm not quite sure what it means. Does this mean content discrimination?
Exactly. Or net neutrality means preventing unreasonable discrimination against content. You know, people want to confuse, and especially the big companies like to confuse with their lobbying and their litigation tactics, the internet itself with the network that we all use to access it, or the networks that we all use to access internet content. You and I are talking on the phone right now. Nobody is regulating what we say, although I guess I need to put a footnote. The NSA could be listening. Let's forget that for just a second. But there's no FCC regulation of what you and I say to each other on the phone, and nor should there be. That doesn't mean that the phone network should be completely free of public oversight, or that the company should be free to discriminate in terms of who you can call and say, well, if you want to call Matt today, that's going to cost you an extra 10 cents. Not because you're actually using more capacity or using more of the service they're selling, but simply based on, you know, who they've cut a deal with, who they like, who they don't like. That's what we're being told should be acceptable on the internet. And when it comes to outright blocking, the companies will say, why would we ever do that? That would be ridiculous. Yet Verizon went to court and had these net neutrality rules struck down that the Federal Communications Commission had put forward. And they basically said, once they got past their arguments about authority and about the merits of the rules, they got to the constitutional question. And they said, you know, the internet is really more like a newspaper than it is like a phone system. And what that means is we at Verizon should have editorial discretion over the internet content we transmit. they want to make themselves into a speaker, not just on their own website, which is, you know, really fine. And again, not to stray off into other territory, but, you know, we can debate Citizens United all day. You know, if a company has a website, they should be free to say what they want on that website. But they shouldn't be free to edit your and my speech when we've contracted with them to carry that speech, and whether that's commercial or political or anything else. And that's really where Verizon and others would like to insert themselves in order to make more money out of the system by charging people different rates or even outright blocking some sites. The discrimination component, I think, is probably more likely, not just outright blocking a particular website or application or service that you get over the top of your internet connection, but charging more to reach certain sites or applications, and especially ones that they don't happen to own themselves at the cable or telephone company. And, you know, as you said, with political speech, maybe not blocking it, although I wouldn't say it's out of the question, but putting it into sort of a backwater, you know, sort of the internet for everybody else that isn't quite as fancy or as sophisticated or as fast as the place where you'll find commercial offerings that are able to and willing to pay for that prerogative and for being put at the front of the line.
That makes a lot of sense. Bloggers like Law and Disorder or the other blogs that are critical of the status quo and supportive of the various movements for social justice, they might find themselves in the back of the bus.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they've talked about this in terms of, and even the FCC has drifted off in this direction occasionally, and we don't think that's a good idea, but they've talked about, you know, maybe Verizon or somebody else, Comcast or Time Warner Cable, could offer a best of the internet, more of a walled garden approach, kind of like what you would have seen from AOL 15 or 20 years ago, where you couldn't get to the rest of the World Wide Web or to other internet destinations and services freely, but you can only go where your internet service provider lets you go. And the reason that's especially dangerous now, more so than it was in the case of AOL, is that an internet service provider used to be something that you, or somebody that you went to who rode over the top of an open phone system. Right, back in the dial-up days, there were lots of different internet service providers, and you could switch from one to the other, and it was about as simple, quite literally, as making a phone call to a different number. That's not the case anymore. With broadband, the FCC, again, thanks to years or even decades of effective lobbying by these incumbent service providers, have said, we're not going to treat broadband the same way. We're going to look at the broadband service offered by a cable company or a phone company as something of an integrated whole, and then deregulate down and basically lump in together the speech and the network itself, as I was talking about earlier. You know, we need to hold that distinction and say internet content should not be regulated by the Federal Communications Commission, full stop. Yet the communications network that we all use to get online is something where we need to have a public oversight role and a certain degree of universality and affordability and openness, where there clearly is a role for government oversight at the FCC and even down at the state level. So that's kind of the situation we're in now. Susan Crawford talked about these issues a lot, and I think she said it as well as anyone when she said what the companies want to do is confuse the conversation for the sidewalk. We need these rules to keep open the sidewalks, to keep open the public spaces, and this concept of a public communications network that serves everybody, but without any sort of Federal Communications Commission oversight or even regard for what people say on that network.
Well, the Comcast-Time Warner cable merger is under review now, as I understand it, by both the Federal Communications FCC and the Department of Justice. What I'm concerned about is that the FCC, because of what you said, these years and years of lobbying, I'm not so sure that the FCC is out there to do the right thing. And I'm also concerned about the Department of Justice. So what's your take on how they're going to handle this proposed merger?
Yeah, they're not even officially under review yet because Comcast is taking their time and filing their papers, but they will very soon be under review. And the twin review by both the FCC and by Department of Justice might seem cumbersome, but they actually have very different mandates. DOJ, or occasionally it's the Federal Trade Commission, they basically split up the mergers, and one of them takes them from an antitrust standpoint. DOJ and the FTC are looking to prevent a decrease in existing competition, and that's about as far as they can go. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has a broader mandate than that to make sure the deal is actually in the public interest, and so they can be more proactive and forward-looking at the implications for, you know, potential competition, for future innovation. So we think it's a good thing that both antitrust authorities and the Federal Communications Commission will look at it. And I certainly take your points about not having complete confidence in just how much either of those places are looking out for the public interest. I would say, though, that in the Obama administration, this is a huge deal and maybe one of the biggest in recent memory or of all time, even though those kinds of generalized pronouncements can seem silly. But, it's slightly bigger than, but not much bigger than, two recent ones. Comcast itself bought up NBC only 3 years ago. And then even since then, AT&T Wireless tried to acquire T-Mobile. And in the first case, Comcast NBC went through with some reasonably stringent conditions, I guess you'd say. We don't think they were anywhere near good enough and didn't justify approving the deal. But the Comcast NBC merger went through. AT&T and T-Mobile was actually rejected. And I think it's only fair to say that DOJ took the lead there, but the FCC was following along and provided a lot of technical analysis and got it right on that merger. Last thing I would say, without getting too much into the weeds on antitrust, but this is law and disorder after all, is that the AT&T T-Mobile merger is more obviously horizontal, meaning unlike Comcast and Time Warner Cable, who can credibly, if not very justifiably, note that they don't compete with each other today in the same markets. AT&T and T-Mobile do tend to be in all the same markets, and so that was something of an easier lift from an antitrust standpoint. But again, we think that basically taking two regional monopolies in the cable industry and making them into a super regional or even national monopoly is not a good idea, to put it mildly.
Yeah,
and that DOJ will be well served to step in here as well.
It certainly is a large deal, $44 billion. We're talking with attorney Matt Wood, who's the policy director at Free Press. Matt, you recently testified in Washington about this. Could you give us the essence of what you said down there?
Yeah, so last week the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee had a hearing on wireless competition, so closer to AT&T and T-Mobile, as we were just talking about, than to Comcast and Time Warner Cable, but really all these companies are getting into each other's business these days, and there is a wireless component even to your cable service because we have Wi-Fi, and people tend to take their wired connections and run them right into a wireless router. And so cable is certainly in the wireless space more and more. But that one was really more about wireless competition among more typical wireless providers, AT&T and Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile, who are a rather distant third and fourth now to that big two of AT&T and Verizon. And we went in front of that subcommittee and said, look, wireless is actually more competitive than some other communication industries, especially wired broadband, where you really don't have more than one choice in a lot of places, or maybe two maximum for almost the entire U.S. But we're not seeing all the fruits of that competition among wireless providers because AT&T and Verizon remain so dominant. So AT&T and Verizon between them have about two-thirds, a little more than that, of the wireless subscribers in the United States, and yet they control about 80% of the industry's profits. And Verizon alone has almost 50% of the entire wireless industry's profits. You put the big four back together, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile, and you're looking at 98% of the United States served by one of those four carriers. So it's a highly concentrated industry. It happens to be more competitive, and there certainly have been some good signs from T-Mobile lately pushing the envelope and looking to slash prices to win customers, which is something of a novel idea in the communication space, but it's the way it's supposed to work. There are some encouraging signs, but we still see a lot of dominance and a lot of top heaviness in that market. And especially when AT&T tried to buy T-Mobile, we put a lot of materials out there saying, you think that this is bad, but you might not even understand just how bad it is. This would make the wireless industry far more concentrated, in fact, twice as concentrated as other industries that are anything but competitive. So things like the airlines and the oil industry and autos and banking, where at least you have, a handful of titans left fighting it out. And in the wireless space, we're really down to four, with only the DOJ and the FCC's action to save T-Mobile from AT&T a couple years ago keeping us there, because we could have just as easily been down to three if those agencies had been asleep at the switch for that last deal.
We're speaking with Matt Wood. Matt, you're the policy director at Free Press. If you don't mind me asking you sort of a personal question, how did you get involved in this kind of legal advocacy? What motivated you to do what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. I took about 4 years off after college before going to law school, and in that time was working at the Public Broadcasting Service, among other places. And that was really the first time I thought about law school at all, was seeing the impact that decisions made in Washington had on communications, technology, and policy. And really, our whole mission here at Free Press is to bring people's voices back into those conversations, both inside of Washington and in state capitals, too, when we can make it to those, so that it's not simply, you know, one corporation against another, but that there's also a public interest and a public voice component to those debates. We're usually, you know, outspent by, I can't even tell you how many orders of magnitude, by AT&T and Verizon and Comcast and companies that have, you know, billions of dollars in revenues versus us, which is a relatively small but healthy nonprofit. But I was at law firms for about 7 years after law school, and then made the jump over to the good guys side and the nonprofit space in 2009, and have been at Free Press since 2011.
What can our listeners do to help the struggle here, and how can they get in touch with Free Press?
So yeah, we're at freepress.net on the internet, which is still open and free, but you know we're fighting to keep it that way. And we have actions there that people can take, everything from signing up on a petition and basically just clicking through to getting even more involved by going in person to meet with your member of Congress or with their staff, especially when they're back in their districts during recess. So you know, it's kind of the full gamut of both online activism and good old-fashioned offline activism and organizing that we try to make available. We have about 700,000 members on our email list right now.
Terrific.
And we're out there on social media and the other platforms that people use today to get the word out. So our website is a good starting place and landing page to get started and get more information on these issues we've been talking about today and some others that we work on too.
That's freepress.net. We've been speaking with the policy director at Free Press, attorney Matt Wood. Matt, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Thanks so much for having us on.
Okay. Take it easy.
Goodbye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Law and Disorder is carried on many stations throughout the country, and we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge our sister stations.
Well, first of all, we have WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM. WHYS, Eau Claire Community Radio in Wisconsin, 96.3 FM. KRFP, Free Radio Moscow in Moscow, Idaho.
WRFN, Nashville, Tennessee, Radio Free Nashville, 98.9 FM. KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 106.7 FM. WYAP Clay, West Virginia, 101.7 FM.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7, Castleloft, Alaska. 104.5 FM Radio, Anchorage, Alaska.
WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts. KEIF-FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia.
WPVM, 103.5 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana. Online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online.
WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 and 98.3 FM, Columbus Community Radio, Ohio.
KKFI 90.1 FM in Kansas City, Missouri. Free Radio Santa Cruz. WSLRM FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida.
KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Round Radio. AM 1680, Southwest 13.560, Shortwave. Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut.
WJFF Radio Catskill, New York, 90.5 FM. WDRT 91.5 FM. 89.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine. 99.FM, Bangor, Maine.
You were fishing in Viroqua. KMUD, Garberville, 91.1. KMUE, Eureka, 88.3. KLAI, Laytonville, 90.3. Shelter Cove, 99.5. Voice of Sacramento. Sacramento Community Radio, 88.7. MHC. WWPM, Media Network, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass. KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia 98. FM, Olympia, Washington. WCRS 98.3 and 102.1, Columbus, Ohio.
KSKQ 94.9, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM, Illinois Central College, Peoria, Illinois. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Greene and Columbia Counties, in New York.
KSVR 91.7, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3, 89.9, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington. WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Mass.
WFTE-FM, 90.3 and 105.7, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. WRFI, 91.9, Watkins Glen, New York. WINO 89.9, Odessa, New York. 88.1, Ithaca, New York. WEFT 90.1, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix Online Community Radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio. Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes.
KAOS Olympia, Washington, 89.3 FM. KWTF Sonoma County, California. Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas.
KBU Community Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 106.1 FM. WZRD, Chicago, Illinois, 88.3 FM. Thank you all.